You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's podcast is with Caroline Fleck, who is a licensed psychologist, an adjunct clinical instructor at Stanford University, and a business consultant. She is renowned for her ability to help people make critical but challenging change and is one of Silicon Valley's most sought-after psychotherapists. Her new book, and I love this book, is called Validation: How the Skill Set That Revolutionized Psychology Will Transform Your Relationships, Increase Your Influence, and Change Your Life. Enjoy the pod.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Caroline Fleck, welcome to the podcast.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much for having me, Kelly. It's a pleasure to be here.
So this book had a profound effect on me. I also read to the end of every book I read for this podcast. And in the epilogue, you write that you were diagnosed with breast cancer, quote, exactly 1 week after putting the final period on the final sentence of what should have been the final page of this book. So One thing that we learn in life is that we are not the sole authors of our stories. And I am so grateful that you shared so much of yourself in the pages of the book. It's a gift, truly. And I know when our daughter Nora was diagnosed with cancer just after her 16th birthday, we used every improvisational insight and practice that we could to help us navigate that journey. And losing her, which we did a year later, became another chapter for us. And what I felt you were saying in that epilogue is that your work in this field has only resonated more through the recent pain and trauma. And that is exactly how we felt and how we still feel about our journey and the lessons we picked up along the way. So I see you.
Oh my gosh. Kelly, I'm so sorry. I didn't know.
Me too. Yeah.
And I God, I thought I had it hard, right? But the fact that you're able to maintain that perspective and that that resonates with you, like that just actually gives me so much hope. I want to believe that I would maintain the same, have the same attitude, have the same beliefs around, you know, suffering allows us to connect with other people's suffering if something like that were to happen to me, but I don't know. And so
I think you do. I mean, it's like, it's not like you had it easy.
No, I didn't, but this is a different caliber.
I guess. I don't know. I don't know if it is. I mean, I'll put it this way, because our situation was so public, right? Both Ann and I have been at Second City forever. We're both public figures in this town. We have all these celebrity friends and it got written about and all that. And I go out and give keynotes publicly where I talk about it. And the thing that I realized is people just don't talk enough about their traumas because everyone has their traumas. And all kinds of people would come up and take my hand and tell me about the thing that happened to them. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't trauma porn, right? What it really was like, oh no, I see you and I had that experience and thank you for talking. I was at a talk at Northwestern at Kellogg and it was the photographer who came up to me and she's like, I lost my daughter. And it was the photographer and she gave me a big hug and it was just like, and it was great that we could connect and she felt she had a place to talk. And I don't know, I felt like my platform is one where I can do that. And it felt like your book was doing the same thing.
I mean, that is my ambition, but I couldn't agree more with that statement that in connecting with other people, like there's this sense that that is where we extract and find meaning, right? Like, mm-hmm. I feel like that's the subtext of what you're saying, is that in these quote unquote opportunities, you know, you're going there to deliver a keynote and then you have these moments to just connect with people and be real. And for some reason, we're all walking around like, if we're real, people are going to get really freaked out and like crumble or feel like they need to take care of us. And boy, it is so the opposite, right? Like, they feel seen in seeing their vulnerability in somebody else, I think. At least that's been my experience.
All right. So I'm trying to figure out where to start with regard to, like, you have a great story that starts the book. Very good storytelling. Telling you from someone in the industry. Very good.
Thank you.
Let's actually start there. So your first story in the book is about it's about as high stakes as it gets.
Yeah.
You were 27-year-old doctoral student in clinical psychology in a session with a patient that was simultaneously being monitored by your instructor and 10 other students in another room. And what happened?
Okay, so first of all, how awkward is that, right? And I just to be clear, the client, we often refer to our patients as clients, the client had consented to this, so it's not like they're secretly being recorded and like broadcast down the road. But this is how we train. As therapists, you have certain skills that you need to develop. You have these treatments that are not like sitting back and like analyzing people on a couch while they just ramble like Freudian style back in the day. These are very precise interventions where you need to be hitting your notes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in order to be certified in these treatments, you got to prove that you can do that. And the only way to do that is for someone to see what you're doing. So in this situation, yes, I'm sitting across from this client. We're winding down towards the end of the session. Between you and me, I'm like, I'm doing really well. Like, I have hit every note.
Nailing it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Like, change is happening. And of course, in the last 5 minutes of that session, the client discloses that they're thinking of killing themselves. This is devastating. And it is a devastating mistake that I made not to have assessed for suicidality at the start of the session. All right. Because now we have 5 minutes and I've got to wrap this up somehow or hospitalize them or what. So obviously I want to intervene immediately to reduce this person's risk. Again, this is a therapy. We have all sorts of skills and things that we can help the client do to manage this feeling, this desire, this hopelessness. But there is a problem, which is that all of the skills I'm going to suggest, of the cognitive restructuring I might do, it is all change focused, right? I mean, at its core, I am trying to change their intention. I am trying to change how they feel in that moment, okay? And when you've just been deeply vulnerable, when you feel exposed in that way, and someone attacks you with all the changes you need to make, let me just say, people generally don't respond well to that. They often don't respond well to that, I suppose I should say. Some, you've got your type A's who are like, let's do it. Tell me what I need to do. But for a lot of folks, that shuts them down. And that's what happened in the session. The client just shut way down. And like, I am doing everything I can to kind of re-engage them. But they've just kind of arms crossed, sitting back. I should not have said anything. I'm like, let's look at your skills list. Remember we talked about putting your face in ice water to drop your heart rate and calm you down. And he's like, forget you. And I'm panicking. And as I'm going through this, behind the client, there is a computer monitor where my supervisor can type feedback to me. All right. And I know that I am just not, I am losing the thread here. And I'm waiting and I'm looking at that monitor. And finally, they type the term validation.
Yeah.
And it was like switching from, I don't know if you drove a stick shift at all, but if you're like in a high gear and then you drop really low and there's this sudden like shift in energy that you feel immediately, right? That was how simply seeing that word felt to me. It was like, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. I need to really switch gears here. What seeing that, I knew what that term meant. it meant I needed to convey some degree of acceptance. I needed to focus on seeing the individual, not changing them. Okay. And that is what I did. So I shifted gears and I said something to the effect of like, well, this sucks. Mm-hmm. You know, you just disclosed this very vulnerable thing. And now you're subjected to this graduate student who's desperately trying to, you know, salvage things at the last minute. And that probably doesn't feel very helpful. And this is being broadcast, as you know, to a room full of people. Like this just categorically sucks. And it was in that shift that I saw a little bit of like a smile, right? And from that smile, I was able to build off that more and build off it a little more. And finally, I just said, you know what? Let's get out of this room. Let's go for a walk, which is a little going off script. Mm-hmm. But it was fundamentally when I was thinking, if I was in this person's shoes, what would I need to feel seen? And for me in that, if I was in their shoes, I'd want to get out of this like claustrophobic, feeling exposed space. So I suggested we go for a walk, and that's what we did. And we go on that walk. And my only intention, and I mean this honestly, wasn't to try and get through to them or figure out how to help them change. It was just to help them feel seen. Mm-hmm. We do that. And from there, only if and when that's successful, can I really start to talk about change. Well, I mean, I could talk about it before. It just wouldn't be effective. Yeah.
So, God, how do we... So much. In improvisation, I don't know how much you know about our field, but it is, you know, you're on stage with someone else. You have no yeah. script. We teach you that your job is to save the person across from you. Their job is to save you. That you need to stay fiercely present in the moment. Mm-hmm. That you have to listen to everything the person is saying. You have to yes and, mm-hmm. which means affirm and contribute, but really means explore and heighten together. Mm-hmm. And with no judgment. No judgment of self, no judgment of other, mm-hmm. no fear brain, no shame brain. You are here. It is why so many broken people come to our work. Because they're using therapy.
Oh my gosh, hold on. Let me just... Wow. I'm sorry. That just like so deeply resonated with me on so many levels. I just need to like feel that. That is why so many broken people come to this work. Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
I got it.
When my wife Ann and I started working with the folks at the University of Chicago, we had a 4-year program called the Second Science Project that looked at behavioral science through the lens of improvisation and vice versa. Suddenly, we have this other language for the things we're doing.
Yeah.
And as Nick Epley is talking to us about, people don't self-disclose.
Yeah.
I did this study. Can you create an exercise that will allow uh-huh. people to practice what it means to self-disclose? And we did. So this exercise is called Universal Unique, and we pair people up to have a conversation about grocery shopping. We say, just have a conversation about how human beings grocery shop universally.
Yeah.
And they do that for a minute. Then we say, okay, now you're going to have a conversation about how you grocery shop in detail. Go. Game changer.
Wow.
And they learn things about the because we're all freaks. The way yeah. we grocery shop is telling us everything. And so when Nora was sick at the hospital, we would use this technique. And literally what I would do is, because you have so many caregivers, right?
Yeah.
And then come that time in June, if you're there for a long time, they all change.
Yeah.
You know, that happens. And so I would say every time someone come in, I'm like, this is Kelly. My wife is Anne. This is Nora. This is Eleanor. She also goes by Nora. We both have worked in Second City for nearly 40 years. We have a Bernese Mountain dog named Bentley, who's an asshole. Who are you? And they told us. And it was a complete game changer in this so critical, terrible time where you're so, you know, flooded with confusion. The thing that cut through both for us, and this is the mirroring, this is the copying, all the things mm-hmm. that you talk about mm-hmm. was just introducing the idea of like, I'm going to kind of make you see
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be some perspective giving here
mm-hmm.
In order for there to be perspective taking.
And in so doing, I am going to make it safe for you to show up here as well, right? That is the essence of what you're doing. You are modeling what yeah. is okay here.
Yeah. So you can imagine I'm reading your book just going, yeah. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, you are.
so we should cover DBT.
Okay.
I said that I said something about DBT out loud, and one of my colleagues ran down here and goes, are you talking about DBT? And I'm like, oh yes. I'm obsessed with that. So Dr. Marshall Linehan, dialectical behavior therapy is kind of where some of this starts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Tell us about it.
DBT was a treatment that was introduced in the 90s. So kind of a long time ago at this point, right? Yeah. I mean, relatively speaking, long ago, but long enough that I think we should have extracted more from it because it was an absolute game changer for the field. I cannot underline this enough. It transformed psychotherapy as we know it. What she did was to combine what we call behaviorism, which is concepts that folks are actually familiar with, like positive reinforcement, shaping, modeling, right? Mm-hmm. All of these, what we call change-oriented approaches that we would use in therapy to help people change. She combined that with a corresponding emphasis on communicating acceptance. And she was working, she was studying what at the time was considered to be an untreatable condition, which is borderline personality disorder, or BPD. And so folks with BPD struggle with pervasive problems with emotion regulation. And the emotion dysregulation manifests in all sorts of ways, often self-harm behavior, suicidal behavior, interpersonal issues. All right. So this was is still considered to be, unfortunately, a difficult population to work with. And there was and still is a lot of stigma around this condition. And Marcia came in and said, I'm going to try and help folks change because obviously there's a lot there that needs to change. There's a very good probability that they will die if they don't. So I can't just be all like acceptance and unconditional positive regard. But I'm going to try and emphasize at the same time that I deeply accept them. And so the motto of DBT is you're doing the best you can and you need to do better. And both of these things can be simultaneously true. And so as a therapist, as a DBT therapist, my job is to kind of be communicating, holding up both of those truths at the same time, kind of every step of the way. So I've got to be really good at communicating acceptance and equally good at facilitating change. If that makes sense. It's kind of wild.
It does make sense. Here's another wild loop I'm going to throw you, which is we use improvisation to help hostage negotiation trainers.
Oh my gosh, my book must have really resonated with you because what you just said, you know what you said resonated with me and I know why. You know why?
I know. And I talked about it with Gary Nesser, who is sort of the dean of this. I just interviewed him. He got recommended by one of the agents that we work with. And I was telling him about reading your book.
Yeah.
And his yes and story.
Yeah.
I am blowing this for the people that listen because Gary's podcast is going to come after yours. But it was that he showed up at a negotiation. He was replacing the other negotiator. And he said, all right, so where are things at? And they're like, nothing. And it's like, did he ask for anything? He goes, yeah, he asked for Coke. All right, so you got him the Coke. He's like, no, because what was I going to get in return? And Gary's like, give him the effing Coke. You don't need anything in return. You are... The yes and you are doing with these people is you have a need. I could actually do that. I can do that thing I'm doing, like, because you're thirsty, because you need something, whatever it was. He goes, but it was a larger, it wasn't just like, if he wouldn't give him the Coke, he was going to give him nothing. And that's the mindset that he has been battling
in
law enforcement forever.
Yes. 100,000 times yes. The research does not align with the practice that we see,
right?
The practice is universally punitive. It bends that way as if people will collaborate with you, be honest with you when they feel threatened by you, I mean, can we just say that out loud? How nonsensical does that sound? It doesn't make sense, no. Right? And the research supports that. And yet it is an uphill battle to make that point. Now, I'm going to say something perhaps kind of inflammatory, which is that I personally experience this, what feels like a very similar uphill battle in working with clients, couples, people today, talking about politics on the right and the left. Mm-hmm. It is this, I cannot, what am I going to get in return, right? I can't validate any part of that, or else they'll think I agree with them, or mm-hmm. else they'll think X, Y, and Z. And so we're at this similar place of like, I just need to really, you know, smack it down, and somehow that's going to lead to better communication and them understanding where I'm coming from. It's asinine.
We convince no one that they're wrong because we're right.
Yes. Yes.
I mean,
yes.
I mean, ever.
Yes.
Ever.
Yes.
Ever, ever, ever. We're working on this new limited episode podcast. Have not announced it yet. So people are listening to this here at first. But I'm working with my friend, Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, who has the psychology podcast, and my friend, Allison Reese, who's a second city trained comedian. And it's going to be called This Might Be Awkward. And we're going to be interviewing people that have extreme views. And we're going to try to use the tenets of improvisation and a little bit of comedy to see what happens when we don't live in a space of judgment, have these conversations. So we've lined up some pretty major people who have very extreme points of view.
Yeah.
And I'm just so excited to see where this can go, especially right now.
Yes.
And I feel like it's reclaiming agency. We do not get through all of this in a zero-sum game.
Right.
If we play the zero-sum game, we all die.
Exactly. That is exactly right. It's instinct, but the higher the stakes are, the more we seem to result to that which will destroy us, right? Yeah. We get very attack, defend, very fight, flight, and the stakes are just too high. And that strategy served us in the wild, not in the intellectual arena.
Yeah. You write in the book, and I think this is, I want to like double down on what validation is.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is maybe a part of it. You say in the book, quote, "You can't just write off someone as a jerk. Instead, you have to figure out what's reasonable or valid in the jerk's perspective, which will inevitably challenge your conclusion that they're just a jerk."
Yeah. And you know where I had to learn how to do that? When you're a therapist, you don't get to choose your clients. Certainly not when you're training, you're coming up. They're assigned to you. And folks who are coming to therapy, especially folks with severe psychopathology, they're often saying and doing things that are incredibly problematic, to put it non-judgmentally, and severely asshole-y, to put it judgmentally. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of problematic stuff. That's why they're seeing me. Mm-hmm. And I've got to figure out how to work with this person. And there is no way to work with them if you cannot humanize them. And so my strategy is to find something valid in what they're saying, in what they're doing, or what they're feeling. I don't need to validate all of it. Mm-hmm. I just need to find the small little kernel of truth in their perspective. I need to see that, and then I can build off it. But that is the name of the game. Like, you can't just go, they're an asshole.
Right.
Like, you don't have that luxury.
And you have this qualifier throughout the book. I mean, we're not talking about people who are in physically abusive relationships.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
We aren't. But the amount of interactions we have with humans any given day, that is not the big percentage.
Right. You mean like, wait, the...
We're not like dealing with Nazis, like at an overwhelming. I'm not interviewing a bunch of Nazis that I have to keep like trying to see the humanity behind them.
Yes,
but so yes, there's qualifiers, but I think people get stuck in that. It's like it's the trans argument too. Like,
yes.
The smallest percentage that we're talking about. Why are we living inside what is the smallest percentage?
Yes. Yes. I would say that again, this might, I'm going to just get myself in trouble. It's fine. Yeah. Like many psychologists, and they're not going to tell you this, but I'll tell you this. We're often deeply fascinated by serial killers.
Sure.
We are. Like, I can't tell you how many of us, like, I will read just like Wikipedia article after Wikipedia article to fall asleep. Like, mm-hmm. It's just like, it's like playing like solitaire before bed, which is a very screwed up thing to say. But the reason I do it, and I think a lot of psychologists are drawn to it, is we are trying to solve this puzzle. We know that we would have to potentially work with this person, right? And we have to solve for how can I validate them without reinforcing something that's problematic?
Yeah.
How can I find the humanity in their experience and still be effective and not condone them and hold on to my values? And that is a real exercise. But it's one I encourage people to explore.
Well, when you have a superpower.
Yeah.
And I think both of us do. They're different, but we have them. My friend Nira Ayal said this to me, which is, it's not a superpower unless it can also be used for evil.
Yes, yes.
And I am thoroughly convinced that what improvisation does and what validation does is what the best con men use. Like, they see you. Get myself in trouble. I remember meeting Bill Clinton, and I'm of a leftist politics, so I'm not like against that, but there was something that I wasn't like, I was picking up on something. That
really?
I didn't like.
Really?
And it turns out my friend who I was with, who was taking a photo with him, he had slipped his hand underneath her bra on her back.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you
and
sensed
like,
it.
That's, I sense something like, and it's like, and like he had, and we've heard all the stories, so this is mm-hmm. surprising to anyone. So mm-hmm. what made him so incredible in his ability to empathize and communicate, mm-hmm. he could also use in very nefarious ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think it's a responsibility of anyone who dwells in these areas to at least understand how that can be used. So, you know, potentially you're in a situation that you have to be more careful.
It's a very good point. And I would argue that they are tactically doing many of the things that I would recommend, right? They might copy, they might self-disclose. However, the critical distinction is that they don't genuinely accept you. They're not genuinely connecting. So it is, in a sense, like the used car salesperson, right? Like, they can kind of say and do some of the things that are going to hit the right notes. But you also get the sense, as you did, that something's off here. Right? Like, it's not genuine. And even like a really sophisticated talker, politician like Bill Clinton, you can often still feel it's off. Right? It's just something to like to reflect on, because I get that all the time. Well, aren't people just going to use this to manipulate others? I mean, you can use positive reinforcement to manipulate others as well. Like, you can.
Sure.
Right? And at the same time, once you're using it to manipulate others, you've kind of fundamentally undermined what it is that it's no longer validation, because validation is the communication that you see and accept somebody, right?
And you say, again, over and over in the book, for good reason, validation can't be faked.
No. As soon as you fake it, you're doing something else. It's manipulation, it's exploitation, but it's not validation. It's different. Although it can look the same, right? You're using some of those same tactics that I might use to validate someone, but you're not coming at it authentically. I could make up a story that resonates with something you share, and you could feel, oh yeah, like, she gets it, right? But it's not true. It's inauthentic.
So I've been using this. Mm-hmm. I probably finished the book a week and a half ago and did my notes and all that. And I've had numerous situations where I would have had been half attentive to the person who's in front of me that I was like, okay, I realized I've got like 3 minutes with this human who's coming in, who is in distress about a thing. Mm. I'm going to put my pen down. I'm going to look at them. I'm going to be, and I did this. I said, this sounds terrible. What I'm hearing your situation is, it sounds terrible. It also sounds like you're doing the things you need to do to get out of that situation. So I want to applaud you for that. And I said, what can I do? Like, I would like to, if I can help in any way, I have a car. I have some other things I can do. What is there something? And she said to me, I just need your ears when I walk in the morning. I go, well, you got it. And that, you know, and the next day was better. And the next day was better. Got an argument with my wife about something. And I literally was sort of like, okay, I pulled back. And Alison Wood Brooks writes about this in her book called Talk, where she has some research that shows that you should always apologize.
Oh, yeah.
And you read about that, too. And I was like, and people, I'm going to tell you right now, people are going to effing hate that. They're going to hate that that's in your book. And it is always true. Just apologize. It doesn't even matter if I think I'm right. I think I'm right. It's like, her feelings are what they are. Her feelings are valid, because why wouldn't they be? Her emotions, whatever you want to call it. And I just was like, I'm sorry you had to go through this thing. I'm sorry I put you in that. I'm so grateful you went to this event with me. And I know it made you uncomfortable. And, you know, that's, I see that. And it was like, the rest of the day was great. And I'm like, oh, that could have gone very different.
Such a, like, nuanced thing that I really want to point out that you're doing there, that I think is, it's just so critical. Instead of getting caught up in, like, do I agree or disagree with this person's interpretation of events? That's what we tend to get locked into during conflict, because we don't agree. We have our version and it is very different and it is right. Instead of putting your energy there, you focused on how she felt. I don't think you doubted that she was distressed, upset. You could see that. That was real, right? Oh, you could see that.
Yeah.
And you just focused on that, right? You don't have to agree with how she got there to attend to how she's feeling. Now, here's the funky thing. Here's the beautiful, magical thing. Once you do that, oftentimes you are then in a position to give your perspective in a way that they can hear. So interestingly, whatever change you're hoping to do in terms of how they're thinking about this situation, you're much more likely to get there if you signal acceptance, understanding, and empathy first. We just flip the order on those things, and so we never get to the second part.
Yep, yep. All right. I want to talk about the taking action section, and I want to explain an improv exercise that we do, and then let you go with what you want to say about it. So there's an improv exercise that we use often called thank you statues. And what we do is we get everyone in the circle and we say, we need one person to go in the center of the circle and strike a pose. And so someone sends it, they do it. Okay, now what's going to happen is anyone who's on the outside of the circle, you are going to go in and tap that person and strike a news pose. They will say thank you and then leave and go to join the other people in the circle. And we keep doing that. Go. So what happens is no one goes inside. And then someone finally does. And we say, okay, wait. So we want to talk to the people. Why didn't you go into the circle? It's like, well, I wasn't sure I had the right pose. And then we ask the person inside the circle, what did you want? I just wanted someone to come in. That's all they needed to do. And this is that we talk about intent versus action. And like, and it's like, it doesn't matter that your intent was that you wanted to do the right thing or whatever. Like,
right,
you needed to do was go in and strike a pose. That's all they, that's all that person needed in that moment. And then we do it again.
Yeah.
And by the end of doing it, if around three rounds, people are running in there. They're running in there. They're running in there. And it's like, it's beautiful to see. And it's joyous. And it's like, yeah, you're just saving over and over these people.
So just so you know, I fully intend to steal that and use it in my DBT groups when we talk about participating, which is throwing yourself in. That is an amazing exercise. It also highlights this really critical point that I think is central to validation and pretty much my life, which is that we tend to look at it from like, how are others going to see me? Like, how am I going to be perceived versus what does the individual or the group need? Right. And once you pivot in that way, it's so much more effective and liberating, right? Like, once you stop looking out through the lens of the ego and through the perspective of what's in the best interest of the group or others, you will change what you do in ways that serve you. In my opinion, in my experience, it will serve you.
1,000%. Let's talk about relationships and the use, because we kind of touched on that. There was a few of these quotes that I read out to our CEO and my friend Ed Wells that he just started laughing about. One was, quote, "We tend to underestimate what registers as punishing to our partners." One was, quote, "You don't need to draw attention to any mistake your partner made to help them do better next time." This hurts, by the way. Just so and I love this one, quote, "Give your partner the benefit of the hurt."
Yes. Yes.
It's so simple, which is the problem. Just so you know.
Well, no, it's what you did in actually that example that you gave just a second ago. Yeah. You had an argument with your wife. You gave her the benefit of the hurt, right? Yeah. You said, "I know she's feeling this way. Like, I don't doubt that she's feeling this way. And like, I'm not going to litigate the points. I'm just going to like attend to that." And you're right. It is so simple. It's frustrating.
Let's double click on attending, because we're always like, we used to talk, in improv, we talk about listening. We have exercise on listening. A lot of people hire us for that, of course, because of course you have to be a good listener to be a good improviser. And then there was the term active listening, and there's other terms, whole body listening, whole human listening, all these things. You talk about attending, which is the thing I'm going to steal from you.
Yay.
Which is different, because when you're attending, you are doing a lot of work in your listening, which could be clarifying, which could be making a mistake, but then recovering from that mistake, which is also taking all your knowledge of what you know about this person, their history, and it could be their history from earlier this morning or their history from 7 years ago. That is all what's going on in this moment. And that is not easy. But again, if you want to talk about a superpower, if you want to talk about walking around and building relationships that are going to serve you and your fellow humans, do that.
Yeah, there's this, the two kind of aspects of attending. There's the physical kind of nonverbal stuff, which I think a lot of people are familiar with. There's the nodding, you know, smiling, leaning in. But then there's this cognitive part. And I like to get super nuanced about what that looks like. Because, you know, the ways I've heard active listening and some of these similar concepts described, they're still somewhat passive.
Yeah.
Even though there's like this active, you know, in the title, there's still a passivity to it. So when you're attending, it's more like you are in a debate and you have been kind of asked to argue a position that you may or may not agree with. It doesn't matter. You're on the side that has to argue why smoking is good for you, right? Yeah. And you have to collect all that data and everything else, and you have to make that argument. So the two things you're looking for when you attend, it's this two-part game that you're playing, which is, what's this person's point and why does it matter to them? Like, what are they trying to say? And how would I do a better job of making that point? And this is not because you're super smart and better than them. It's because they're coming up with their arguments on the fly, right? Like, they're just doing the best they can in that moment. And your job is to try and think, how could I make this more concise, clarify it, substantiate it, right? Like, as if you had to argue that point. Now, here's the critical thing. You don't have to surface any of your beautiful insights, right? This is just intended to inform how you listen. Because here's what you will notice. When you're trying to solve for, like, how do I make this better? What is there? What's the genesis? You know, what's the real root of the issue here? You ask different questions. You inflect at different points. It fundamentally changes how you listen. And if you don't believe me, watch some of the great late night hosts. And by great late night hosts, I'm talking, I mean, my greats, like, Stephen Colbert, mm-hmm. love him, right? Jon Stewart, Larry King. They are trying to bring out the best interview in the person they're talking to. And you can tell, based on the questions they're asking and how they're engaging the guest, that they are playing this game in their head. They're trying to figure out, what's this person's point? Why does it matter? And how could I help them make it, right? So that they give the best performance. They're helping them. They want to help them. And that's reflected in how they listen.
So Colbert was my wife Anne's roommate at Northwestern.
And oh my God.
Was in my first cast at Second City.
Oh my Lord!
And if you like him, know that he texted Anne every single day that Nora was sick. And that at her memorial service, he made sure to double tape the episode and then chartered a plane so that all our writer friends in a show and he could be here for that service. And then sit with us.
Taking action, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and for people who don't know, this is someone who's also been deeply wounded in his life and has experienced a lot of loss. And he's been pretty open about that. And he sat with her friends and talk about attending. I mean, this is someone who just does that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story. But before that, I want to test another thing out on you. And I'm sorry.
I love it.
So I believe we were introduced by our mutual friend, Dave Nussbaum. Right?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So Dave, who's a professor at the University of Chicago, married to also an awesome professor at the University of Chicago, is working with my wife, Anne, and I on the potential follow-up to Yes And. We think we're going to write this book. We're feeling pretty good about it. And in our last conversation, which was kind of talking about you and your book, because I was midway through it, I had this sort of aha moment about what improvisers are doing that I don't think anyone has identified this schema. And I tested it out with Laura Huang, who we just had on the podcast recently. That's where the idea came, and then I brought it to Dave and Anne, and they got excited about it. Okay. I think what improvisers are doing is two things that our culture does not hold as connected, which is they are incredibly open to experience. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets that. Of course you are. You're an artist. You're an improviser. Like, mm-hmm. The other thing they're doing is incredible quick decision-making.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like System 1 and System 2 as a practice in real time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're open to experience and they're quick at decision-making. They're open to experience and they're quick at decision-making. Tracks. I see it. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I don't know who trains that. Like you would think that'd be like, oh, well, that's the training I want. I want to be able to be incredibly curious so I can get an abundant amount of ideas so I can know what all this stuff is. And I want at any given time to be able to go, let's market that. Let's sell that. Let's connect with that, whatever it is, and act. And I just, I feel like they belong to different cultural domains, except they don't.
Yeah.
And there's got to be other areas where that's going on.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to really think on that because it's fascinating. I mean, it also strikes me that like part of the decision making would also be like a certain risk tolerance, right? Yes. Because they're willing to take social risks in a big way. And again, there's also the prioritization of the group or the performance or the other person, right? Which there's like an almost selfless quality to it that I think is baked in there as well to some extent. Do you disagree?
No, absolutely. Okay. But the thing you also say, which you write about in the book, is that ability to recover and pivot.
Yes, yes,
I mean,
yes.
Literally, my wife, Anne, has been teaching Oprah Winfrey as identifier of status in her comedy classes for decades.
I love it.
Like, literally, here's tape of her. Look at this woman who's more powerful maybe than the person they're talking to is leaning over, is like touching their knee, is taking this breath, is doing all that. You know who else does that is Tina Fey.
Oh, yeah? Oh, now I got to go back. Hold on. I'm also a huge Tina Fey fan. So hold on.
It's 30 Rock. 30 Rock is
her. Oh, you're so right. Yeah.
She's in charge. She wrote the show. She showed around the show. She's the star of the show. All she is doing is being subservient to these idiot men.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And by the way, behind the scenes as well.
Ah, that would make sense.
Mm-hmm.
This is so fascinating. Like, we need to just talk about this. I mean, this is what you're talking about, right? You're saying you're writing a book about this, but this is incredibly fascinating. I'm particularly interested in how you train it up. Like, you know, as a therapist, that's something people aren't born therapists. Like, I don't, there's like so many skills and stuff these people, that you master. And frankly, many of them we should teach in like second grade because they're just right good for like connecting with humans. But there's a science to it. So for instance, that like recovery thing that you're describing, like I viscerally remember in some of those training moments, like just seeing like recover, like the word, you know, like from when I'm like smooth and move is what
I can say. I can tell you how we teach that here.
How do you do it?
There's an exercise called Take That Back. So you have two people have a conversation, and at any point, the third person has a bell. And whenever they ring it, whatever the person who's speaking says, they have to take back what they said and do something different. And often the bell will go boom, 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 and they have to rapid fire into it. And people are blown away by their ability to pivot and then land in something that is often very funny.
Yeah.
And then when both do it, it's like, yeah, you don't get to practice that. You don't get to practice the taking it back. But indeed, so we did this with the hostage negotiation group and the law enforcement, and they loved it. They're like, oh,
really?
Yeah, because they don't know what situation they're walking into.
Sure.
And they're like, and it's like, you think you can stop yourself from saying the wrong thing? You will not stop. This one guy had a potential jumper. She's on a bridge and he's talking about the water. He's like, why am I talking about the water? and then he just pivoted and it was gone. It was like, yeah, that's gone. That's in the past. Now focus on where you're at.
Can I tell you how we teach it? Yeah. So our framework is smooth and move. So like, you know, you've stepped in it or the client is like, you know, really you're in a group setting and one person is kind of going off the rails. You just need to like, make it okay and move on. Right. Yeah. So like, don't draw attention to it. Go on to the next thing, smooth and move. And the way we teach it is through modeling. So you watch session after session after session of therapists smoothing and moving, right? Maybe saying the wrong thing there, actually invalidating the client there and moving quickly to repair or switch gears. And once you see it enough over and over and over again, it decreases like the shame factor that you feel like you're more in pattern matching mode when it happens. Like, that thing's happening right there, right? As opposed to like, oh my gosh, how could I have said or done this? Everyone's judging me. The world's going to end.
And you're watching game tape.
Yes, exactly. That is right. Yeah, that's right.
All right. I don't want the conversation to end. And let's assume it's not going to, because we can talk in the future. But for the purposes of this podcast, we always end with a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
I don't feel like I have a good example of one. Like, I'm still needing a good example of a yes and from you.
All right. Let me look at my notes, because I know you like, I didn't get to any of this crap I wanted to talk to you about. And by crap, I mean really, really good stuff. All right. Here's one.
All right.
You talk about dialectics replacing the either or with the both and perspective, allowing for the coexistence of opposites. Wendy Smith is a good pal of mine who wrote the book Both And. And she observed a class we were teaching and was talking about how improvisation creates this bedding by which all the people, just by doing these exercises together, kind of formed an instant group that felt like people felt like they were okay to share. And it was really palpable to her that it happened because we led with these exercises, these sort of really simple, and some of them were mirroring exercises. And I feel like the yes and that I was seeing in your book was, you know, you were this child who was like an empath. And then it kind of turned on you at a certain point.
Yeah, in a big way.
But then you wouldn't be sitting here talking to me about this stuff, having this like really rich, great conversation, because I'm just so grateful to be able to talk to you.
Likewise.
It wouldn't have happened without the bullshit. And at some point you yes-anded who you were to become who you are.
Ooh. Boy, that hits. That really hits. I think part of what hits there for me, not just that I take that as an incredibly deep profound compliment. And I thank you for it. But also because it's just like my fight song. It is the fight song that I want to, that I try and instill in my clients, that you have that capacity to yes and in that way, no matter what life throws at you. No, screw that. Because of what life throws at you. That is the difference, right? Because you are going through this, you must do those yes and pivots, or else it will define you. Mm-hmm. Energy is neither created nor destroyed. And that crap will destroy you if you don't figure out how to channel it. So I think that's kind of what just hits me as you say that, is like, oh, that's what I want to do. That's what I want to inspire in others. And if any of that came through or is reflected in anything I say or do, that's just, you know, the highest compliment.
Well, because you have to do it. This is the thing that people would always say to me, is like, how'd you do that? Well, I had, what was my choice? We know what my choice was. We all know what my choice was. It either breaks you or post-traumatic growth.
Post-traumatic growth.
I don't see, there's not, I mean, there's toggling, of course. Yeah, there's other things that happen. But really, that's my experience in this shitty community I belong to.
Yeah.
You know, and I just saw a Facebook post before I got on here about a friend who lost her daughter.
Oh, God.
It's the anniversary. It's her birthday.
Oh, my God.
But it is living in community of like, and she's saying it, and she's posting a picture, and she's, I'm like, great, do that. Say it out loud. That's how we move along.
And then, I mean, I also think there's something about like you seeing utility in supporting that person and your unique position to do that, right? Like you see all that. That is what we have to focus on.
Yep.
Not, I mean, it's more easy to focus on all the reasons it's wrong and unfair and shouldn't have happened to you. And while all that is true, it is a weight in one of those old like prison movies that you're like carrying around, right? That is what it will be.
Yep. So I have to recommend this book to everyone.
Thank you.
It's called Validation, How the Skill Set That Revolutionized Psychology Will Transform Your Relationships, Increase Your Influence, and Change Your Life. Change mine. Caroline Fleck, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Kelly.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
being grown for the rest of your life from adulthood. No one survives.